It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North with this Civil War-themed program. Coming up a bit later, we'll hear about a Wisconsin woman who vocalized the need for a federal soldiers' home system to care for wounded Civil War veterans. One of the three original soldiers' homes, established by President Lincoln shortly before his assassination, is located right here in Milwaukee. It's now known as the Milwaukee Soldiers' Home Historic District. It's also the inspiration for a new book on Civil War veterans by Marquette history professor James Martin. While there's plenty of information about how soldiers lived during the war, Martin wanted to know what happened to veterans when they returned home. His book, Sing Not War, The Lives of Union and Confederate Veterans in Gilded Age America, focuses not just on veterans in soldiers' homes, but also on those attempting to fit back into civilian life. He tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce how Northern soldiers were received when they came back.
These were young guys coming home. They're in their mid-20s by the 30s. I mean, the armies were a little bit older then than we think of them now, I think, but they're still young guys. And by the early 1870s, they're being called old soldiers, you know, and these are guys a lot younger than I am being called old soldiers. And you see newspaper articles already in the late 1860s, in the North especially, let's not forget about the soldiers, you know, or talk about them kind of passing from our memory. And they'd come out, of course, for Memorial Day and 4th of July, or Decoration Day was what Memorial Day was called then. Veterans organizations became very important in the 1880s. The Grand Army of the Republic is the big one for the North, the United Confederate Veterans organized in the early 1890s in the South. And so there's kind of informal events that they'd come out. But I think, again, especially in the North, there was the sense that the war is over, the economy is booming, we got westward expansion to continue. And I'd have to say most veterans probably thought the same thing. Let's go. You know, let's go. Let's just do this. But they still – there was a bit of a disjunction between the way veterans and non-veterans thought about their service as the years went on.
Let's talk a little bit about the reintegration of veterans back into civilian life, especially those you focus on in the book who maybe had more difficulty than others. How representative was their experience trying to reintegrate into civilian life for the majority of Civil War vets?
I think what made it difficult, and there are hundreds of thousands of men who are located on a spectrum from being severely disabled, having lost a couple of limbs, to being just sort of slightly not quite well yet. This is a time when dysentery and flu and other diseases that either we don't really get anymore or we manage with over-the-counter, you know, drugs could really be debilitating. A lot of these northern men especially had gone into southern climates and places where they'd gotten malaria or typhoid of some kind. There's also a different strain of typhus. And you don't really ever come out of that. You know, you're always kind of weakened by it. Or they were sleeping on the ground for 2 years or in all kinds of weather, and they're just kind of worn down. It won't really be until the 1890s that doctors start recognizing that, you know, when you're young and you have 3 years of hardship like that, you're not going to recover. But in the meantime, there are a lot of guys, I mean, the obvious ones who've lost a leg or an arm, the much less obvious ones that are just not quite, don't quite have the energy. They've lost out somehow, and they believe they've lost out too because of this. There's no support for these guys. Pension, there is a pension for disabled soldiers and their widows and children for the ones that had died. There are some soldiers' homes starting to pop up here and there, but they're just expected to go back home and do what they did. And so I don't think the kinds of problems that they faced were more severe than problems faced by soldiers now. But there's just no way of supporting them. There's no welfare system. There's no unemployment insurance. There's no GI Bill. There's nothing like that. And so being reintegrated back into society was really difficult for some of them at a time when you were expected to support yourself, you know, and where if you didn't, it was your own fault.
Now, you talk in the book that there was a little bit of a difference, though, between Northern veterans and Southern veterans in terms of forgiveness by general society if you didn't have a smooth reintegration.
Because things are so bad in the South as a whole, I think. I mean, it was the Southern economy never really recovered from the Civil War, at least until well in the 20th century, in terms of the agricultural production that they did. And then most Southern Confederate soldiers were farmers or plantation owners or sons of plantation owners before the war. And it was very hard if you were disabled And so the Confederates had the same spectrum of disabilities from severe to mild that Northern veterans had. It was hard to make a living doing what you were doing. And even if you were successful, cotton prices were low, sugar prices were low, everything that you were expected to make money on didn't really work very well. And so it was pretty hard times in the South. And I think that might have made Southerners more sympathetic toward veterans who weren't making it. There's also, and I talk about it in the book as well, and anyone who knows about the post-war in the South will understand what I mean by the lost cause, which is this very romanticized version of the pre-war period and a very idealistic memory of the war itself, why they were fighting the war, becomes very complicated for us today, I think. But especially how they saw the men who had fought the war, they kind of gave them a pass on almost everything. They wouldn't use that terminology, but this sort of the sense you get that as long as if you're a Confederate veteran, you're fine with me. You know, no matter what you do, no matter how you act, there are things said about Union veterans that are never said about Confederate veterans. The ones that are alcoholics or beggars on the streets or in other ways don't fit into the way Northern society believes a man should behave. In the South, the same behavior occurs. It's just, well, they suffered a lot. You know, they fought for the cause. They become monuments to the lost cause in a way that Union veterans aren't quite the same monuments to the Union cause, I think.
How did the issue of the volunteer soldier complicate the experience for Northern veterans?
Well, as you imply, most soldiers were volunteers. Both the Confederacy and the Union did have a draft. Relatively few Union soldiers were actually drafted. If their name came up, they probably enlisted because they could control what regiment they went to then. In the South, it was a larger percentage, maybe 15 or 20%. But still, most men were volunteers. And I guess it really only becomes an issue in the North because a volunteer is a volunteer. You know what you're getting into is the implication. Clearly, patriotism is the driving force and why you're joining the cause against the Confederacy to support the Union. And that's that. You get paid for it. And certainly, if you lose an arm, the government will give you $18 a month or it changes over time. And then that's that. Now, what complicated things is that veterans, especially by the 1880s, began organizing to get bigger pensions and more pensions and a wider variety of ailments that qualified as pensions. And so there are several steps by which by the 1890s, virtually any Union veteran could get a pension if he applied for it. You didn't have to have a disability caused by service. You didn't have – old age was a disability by that time. You just had to have had a very minimal – it's like 90 days of service, I believe. And you'd get some sort of pension. Again, we might be talking about $6 a month, but a pension, you know, that would help. So they pushed that really hard. And the debate about it does come down to what does it mean to be a volunteer? Does it mean you're going to come back and ask for more later? So time again, there is no one else is getting money from the government. There's no welfare. There's no unemployment insurance. There's nothing remotely like this. There's barely pensions in the private sector. It's really quite a stunning turn of events, and billions of dollars are spent on these pensions. And that's what complicates how people think – part of what complicates how people think about veterans. They seem to be going back on their pledge in a way. They were volunteers, but now they're acting like mercenaries, and they'll be called mercenaries a lot by anti-pension politicians especially.
The issue becomes very politicized, something that I think – soldiers' issues today get politicized in many ways.
Up to a point, although you're not going to hear anybody say, let's not give so much to the soldiers. Military issues, I think, are politicized. Soldiers' issues are not.
Interesting, though, that back then with the Civil War soldiers, those who fought to preserve the Union were not quite thought of in this same way, removed from the politics.
Exactly. And this is a weird political time as well. The parties are very close in terms of power. I mean, it's not unlike today in a certain way. I don't think it's quite as virulent, you know, in some ways. I mean, the rhetoric is pretty virulent, but they're not fighting over very important things for the most part because they just want to keep on to whatever power they happen to have. And pensions become something that really gets legs, you know, in terms of being a thing that they write about. And it's very much a Republican Party, the party of Lincoln, the party that won the war, the party that freed the slaves, are also the party of the old soldiers. And the GAR, while supposedly nonpartisan, is absolutely an auxiliary of the Republican Party in most parts of the country. The Democratic Party, which is still the states' rights party, even if you live in the North, you want small government. And so and there's a pretty big surplus from time to time during the Gilded Age. And the Republicans say, well, great, we can give more for pensions. And the Democrats say, let's give it back to the people. Again, the parties are reversed, but there's a certain familiarity, I think, to that rhetoric. Pensions are the biggest expense of the Civil War. It dwarfs the amount of money that was spent on the war over the years because you still have a lot of guys still getting pensions in the 19-teens and 20s.
You also talk about the difference in how the men saw themselves and what others expected of them. Was there a certain amount of mythologizing their experiences? How were the vets able to express their experiences, and were they able to actually keep them for their own?
I'm not sure they wanted to keep them for their own. I mean, it depends on what experience you're talking about. I mean, there are literally tens of thousands of memoirs and reminiscences and diaries and things published, and a lot of them published right after, well, in the 1880s and 90s, turn of the century. One historian has talked about veterans going into hibernation during the 10 or 20 years after the war, because especially the combat veterans, and most men had some combat experience, unlike the current military where, there's a much more complicated system. But most Civil War soldiers, I think it's safe to say, saw some kind of combat. And it was horrific combat, and they didn't write about that very much. During the war, they did. I have read letters home to children in which they don't shield them for what's going on. They talk about seeing, arms and heads and, things like this. It's pretty gruesome stuff. They'll write in the moment. But they don't so much afterwards. And even after sort of the flood of veterans' memoirs begins in the late 1870s, early 1880s, it's really about tactics and about battles and about human interest stories. The bloodshed is implied, but it's not. It's kind of romanticized in a certain way. You get the feeling it's a little bit like Jack Nicholson, you can't handle the truth sort of thing, for civilians hearing this. I don't think they wanted to keep that to themselves. They wanted to publish it. They wanted to have it out there. It's a way that they were able to maintain a kind of individuality in the face of these are the biggest armies that ever marched. Really, the biggest armies ever marching in North America ever, is during this time. And, kind of cogs in a machine and a way to preserve their individuality to show that, this isn't a big modern war where one person doesn't count. They want to kind of keep that as a part of their military service. And so I think they really wanted to tell their stories. As the society kind of leaves them behind, good riddance. They don't really mean it quite that way, but we have our memories and our contribution. We know who we are.
Well, Jim Martin, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about Sing Not War.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. James Martin is the author of the new book, Sing Not War, The Lives of Union and Confederate Veterans in Gilded Age America, published by the University of North Carolina Press. Martin is a professor of history at Marquette University. He's written and edited more than a dozen books, including The Children's Civil War. He spoke with Stephanie Lecce. You can hear more of their conversation about Gilded Age concepts of manhood at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next, we'll learn about a Civil War heroine who urged President Lincoln to establish a soldiers' home hospital in Wisconsin. That's coming up next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.